The date is March 6, 1987, and we're watching Lethal Weapon. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Merry Christmas!
Hello and happy holiday season. Welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Murtaugh to my Riggs.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
And this week, we kick off our Christmas season. So we brought back the guest from our third episode, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, my son, Chris Wells. Chris, welcome.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays, everybody.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's very snowy outside, very appropriate for this Christmas-themed episode.
Yes, big snowstorm that we have going on right now, but we're all still here and we're all still excited. So this week, we are looking back at March 1987 when the movies and theaters were Some Kind of Wonderful, The Barbarians, A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, Raising Arizona, and of course, our movie for today, Lethal Weapon, which earned $120.2 million on a $15 million budget.
And as always, please remember this movie is 33 years old, so there will be spoilers. If you don't want the movie to be spoiled for you, just hit the old pause button, go watch it, come back, and enjoy the show.
But really, if you haven't seen Lethal Weapon, like, what the hell's wrong with you? Now, interesting segue here. Chris decided to join us this week because he has never seen Lethal Weapon until now. Chris, why not?
I just never gotten around to it. I don't know. it's one of those movies where it's so referenced in everything that I'm too old for this shit. It's such a cliche at this point that it's one of those movies that you think you've seen already.
Yeah.
It's your Groundhog Day, your etc. Your Groundhog Day, it's been done in everything. So that's another one I've seen recently just because it's done in everything. It's such a cliche at this point.
That's fair enough. Like, I feel like if you've seen any buddy cop movie, you've seen Lethal Weapon. In fairness to Chris, I've never seen the original Lethal Weapon. I've actually only seen Lethal Weapon 4. And the reason that I saw Lethal Weapon 4 was because at the time I really liked Jet Li.
Yeah, Enter the Drag Queen is definitely a line I remember from that Lethal Weapon.
the quips in this are excellent, I gotta say. That's one of the things I definitely noticed.
So this was your first time seeing Lethal Weapon as well, then?
Yeah, but again, I feel like I've seen it before just because I've seen, I don't know, it reminds me a lot of Rush Hour would be the main one. Like,
yeah.
Rush Hour was probably the Lethal Weapon of my childhood or teenage years, I would say.
Yeah, and for someone that's a little bit older, they might say that 48 Hours was the original buddy cop movie.
Yeah, I actually had to look that up because I was trying to figure out if Lethal Weapon was the original buddy cop movie. I haven't seen 48 Hours, but apparently it's the movie that kind of pioneered the genre.
A little bit, yeah.
So I'll have to go back and watch that one.
Especially when you get the comedy aspect, because of the fact that, you know, I don't know, in this one they didn't cast two comedians or anything like that, or even one comedian, but with 48 Hours, I mean, that's Eddie Murphy right there.
Yeah.
And so that one follows the Rush Hour formula a little bit closer than this one does. This one, they definitely play up the comedy in future Lethal Weapon movies, but this is definitely one of those ones that it's a lot darker, I noticed, than the Lethal Weapons that I know better.
It was a lot darker than I expected it to be, especially like Riggs' character specifically. Mm-hmm. I thought he was going to be way more of a funny guy, and he's really more of a sad man.
Yeah, I gotta say, Mel Gibson does an excellent job in this movie.
He,
like,
is
a very
good
character.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, well, once again, I've found two different taglines, and I just couldn't choose between them. So first is, If these two can learn to stand each other, the bad guys don't stand a chance.
I like that one.
And we have, yeah, we have an ellipses in there even. They can't stand each other, dot, dot, dot. The bad guys don't stand a chance. Or much like the one that we had, was it last week? Where it was the fourth wall breaking one. What was it we did last week?
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Right, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. That's right. Where it was Steve Martin, where they dropped the actual actor's name. This one is two cops. Glover carries a weapon. Gibson is one. He's the only LA cop registered as a lethal weapon. And with it, the lethal weapon is in all capital letters. So I don't know whether maybe this tagline like actually blended into the title of the movie on the poster, but there you go. It right on the tagline. They want to make sure that you know the title of the movie.
Nice.
But these, of course, may not be the best descriptions of this movie. So let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis.
All right. So it's actually kind of funny because my 60-second synopsis, I would say, is it's like a mashup of both those taglines. So here we go.
Okay.
Roger Murtaugh is a family man. Martin Riggs is a short-fused widower with a death wish. Both are cops. While investigating the death of a porn star, the unlikely allies uncover a heroin smuggling operation. In true buddy cop fashion, the two must learn to set aside their differences and learn to work together in order to defeat the mysterious Shadow Company. And that is your 60-second synopsis.
Shadow Company. I don't even think I got that once in the movie.
Oh yeah, no, he does say that. There's the scene where he's just been busted as being a sniper by the general, and he says, "Hey, you're General McAllister of Shadow Company." So he does drop that word in the movie, absolutely.
Oh right, that's the special ops force group. That's right. Right. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, for me, I know, I mean, I mentioned this slightly earlier, but kind of like Police Academy, kind of like Short Circuit, this is one where I just blend all the movies together. And I can't ever remember what movie is which. There's the famous toilet scene, the toilet exploding bomb scene, which I think is Lethal Weapon 2. I was kind of hoping it was going to appear in this movie. But I know that's definitely one of those things that I noticed with this is, yeah, it is that much darker than the other ones. The other ones really lean into the comedy. Mm-hmm.
I feel like the first one falls victim to taking itself too seriously. And then they find the humor in this the sequels following.
Yeah.
They're very similar in tone to Die Hard, like the earlier Die Hards, like Die Hard, like probably Die Hard 1-3.
Before it got a little bit goofy and you're driving semis off of a collapsing
door. Yeah.
Before he's jumping off of F-15 jets. Yeah.
For you, Sean, was this like your introduction to buddy cop movies, or do either of you have a favorite buddy cop movie?
This probably is my introduction to buddy cop movies. Okay. I will say that. I have seen 48 Hours. Rush Hour is also one of those it's right up there for me.
Yeah.
And I like the ones these days that it like just go straight for the comedy. Movies like Ride Along and movies like that. Ride Along might not be the best example, but those type of movies where it's totally played for comedy. I do still enjoy a lot of those.
Yeah, and the first Rush Hour is in my top three movies of all time, top three favorites by nice. Far. I really love Rush Hour.
Yeah.
I don't know if have you guys ever heard of the movie Cuffs with Christian Slater?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I would say that I love that movie when I was a kid. It's kind of a buddy cop movie, I guess, even though the second guy doesn't really get much of a top billing or anything like that, but still yeah. good.
Well, one that I like that is kind of overlooked as a buddy cop movie maybe is The Hard Way, which is a Michael J. Fox, James Woods movie.
Okay.
And Michael J. Fox in that one plays an actor that is riding along with this grizzled cop played by James Woods, and he's trying to pick up tips and everything like that. Interestingly, something that both Mel Gibson and Danny Glover did in this movie was ride along with actual undercover detectives for a while to get an idea of the job.
I gotta say, also, Die Hard 3, it would be a shame not to mention that. It's definitely buddy cop movie.
Did you know? Here's another one that I found out. Interestingly, Die Hard 3 was written as a Lethal Weapon script.
Oh, wow.
I could see that.
The one thing that I read was that Bruce Willis actually originally auditioned to play Riggs, and Mel Gibson also auditioned to play John McClane. So there's a lot of crossover.
I have that in my notes, and it's funny because there are a whole bunch of other people that were in the running for playing Riggs, and they are Alec Baldwin, Jeff Bridges, Pierce Brosnan, Brian Brown, Nicolas Cage, Robert De Niro, Kevin Costner, Willem Dafoe, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Richard Gere, Jeff Goldblum, Rutger Hauer, Don Johnson, Michael Keaton, Kevin Kline, Christopher Lambert, Michael Madsen, Liam Neeson, Michael Nouri, Al Pacino, Sean Penn, William Peterson, Dennis Quaid, Christopher Reeve, Eric Roberts, Kurt Russell, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Tom Selleck, Charlie Sheen, Sylvester Stallone, Patrick Swayze, John Travolta, and Bruce Willis.
That's everybody.
I was going to say, are you sure you're just reading
the list? I was
going to
say, if you didn't mention Schwarzenegger...
No, those were all people that have been considered for the role of Riggs. And funny, with after seeing Mel Gibson's portrayal of what Riggs is, the only two off that list that I could actually see doing the same kind of performance is Michael Keaton and Charlie Sheen.
I was going to say, I feel like I could have saw Nick Cage, because this is Nick Cage, like, I guess it's 10 years away from Con Air and The Rock, but yeah, it's like that Nick Cage, I think, could have also played Riggs.
Well, let's jump into Lethal Weapon. It's directed by Richard Donner, who we've talked about a few times now. Directed Goonies, Superman, all the Lethal Weapons, Scrooged. His first credit was back in 1960 with an episode of a show called Zane Grey Theater. I don't know. It's also produced by Richard Donner, who we talked about as a producer on Lost Boys. But also Joel Silver, who is responsible for The Matrix, all the Lethal Weapons, Sherlock Holmes, V for Vendetta, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and Veronica Mars. It's written by Shane Black, who we mentioned as a writer on The Monster Squad, and Jeffrey Boehm, who we mentioned as a writer on The Lost Boys. And so we open the movie on a tracking shot that goes over the LA skyline at night while the song Jingle Bell Rock plays, until finally flying us around the top floor of a circular tower and in through a window as the music changes to a much more sinister soundtrack, where we see a barely clothed Amanda Hunsucker, who is lying on a couch, and she's played by Jackie Swanson, who has 22 credits, but most notably she was Woody's girlfriend and wife, Kelly, in 24 episodes of Cheers. I want to say how impressive I think this tracking shot is, especially for 1987. I mean, this is pre-drone, and they circle the building and they go in through the window. It's a very impressive shot, and I kind of wonder how they pulled it off.
I was going to say that it really reminded me of the opening of Lost Boys or whatever. So I was kind of with the Richard Donner connection. I was like, maybe he just really likes opening movies on these tracking skylines.
And I also got to say that for someone that is a hooker / porn star, being on the top floor of this building is pretty impressive real estate for this woman to have. Unless she's in someone else's house.
Maybe a hotel.
But it's all decorated for Christmas, so that's somewhere that someone lives. Well, Amanda is clearly on something, which is immediately confirmed as she snorts a line of coke in front of her Christmas tree. Merry Christmas, folks. In her coked out state, she wanders out to the balcony, climbs up onto the railing, thinking she can fly, dives off, and plummets to her death, landing on top of a car. She did this stunt herself, I found out. Like, interestingly, what it is it's a giant airbag, and they've put out like a giant picture of the ground on top of this airbag. And that's how they did the stunt. If you pause it just as she connects with it, you can actually see the ripples of this picture, which is...
I did think it looked weird because the cut that they do to the interior of the car as it crumbles looks very off.
Yeah. So it's very cool that she actually didn't get a stunt person. She trained and did this stunt herself.
Yeah, I kind of thought there was something. Yeah, when I watched it, now that you mentioned that, it kind of makes a little bit more sense. When I was watching it, something about it just looked weird, and I kind of felt like how tall that building was, the damage to the car just didn't seem to line up with how. And I mean, I'm no physics expert or anything like that, but it just seemed like there would have been a little bit more chaos and.
And maybe a little bit of exploding human body, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's very Sleeping Beauty when you come across her at the very end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gotta say also, this scene exemplifies perfectly two of my major takeaways from the movie. And that's that this movie wants you to know that it's a Christmas movie. It takes place at Christmas time. And yeah. If you forget, there will be plenty of reminders, like a exploding eggnog bottle as a guy gets shot later on. Well, but
and what's funny is I was watching the movie, and I was watching it with my girlfriend, and so I'm always on the lookout for my sponsors for Sponsorship Corner, and she goes, look at all that eggnog on his table. First of all, it's not refrigerated, so what the fuck. but I'm looking at it and going, well, it's a funeral, why the hell does he have eggnog? And it took me like probably a full like 20 seconds before I went,
yeah.
Oh yeah, it's a Christmas movie, because I haven't been slapped in the face with anything Christmas for, like, you know, probably about 15 minutes now.
And then the second major takeaway that I had was that this movie is rated R.
Yeah.
Like it hits you over the head with it. It opens with a topless girl doing coke and then tits jumping the off scene. A building. Like it really beats you over the head that this is a Christmas movie and it is rated R, baby.
I was kind of glad that they explained or like were really over the top at the Christmas stuff, because ever since Sean mentioned to me that Lethal Weapon was going to be a Christmas movie, I never understood it, because I never would have thought of Lethal Weapon. And I think part of that is because whenever I think of Lethal Weapon, I'm not thinking of this movie.
Yeah.
But I had no idea that it even took place at Christmas until I heard the opening.
You initially think it's going to be very tongue in cheek, like Die Hard is. Like Die Hard, we joke that it's a Christmas movie, but they acknowledge that probably once or twice, and then in the decoration as well. But with Lethal Weapon, it's like there's a scene that opens up in the police station with the police officers like starting to carol.
Yep.
They're practicing caroling.
Yeah.
Like it's just, it's very, it beats you over the head with
which
it.
Which is the beginning of a running joke throughout the Lethal Weapon franchise as well, is the jumping or the counting 3, 2, 1,
mm-hmm.
right? And the one guy jumping ahead of everyone else, right? Which sets up all the jokes in the future where it's like, okay, on three, you know?
It's funny that you mentioned Die Hard and how people like fight for Die Hard to be a Christmas movie. Because I don't really feel like people fight for Lethal Weapon to be a Christmas movie.
No, but I think...
Am I wrong? Am I wrong?
Because it is one, and it wants you to know it is so badly.
Yeah.
But see, with Die Hard...
They say Merry Christmas like a dozen times in that movie, like unwarranted. That guy talking about guys in the 80s, they feel too much in front of women, you know? And then he walks away and goes, hey, Merry Christmas.
But with Die Hard, at least, you know, you say that you think of the other Lethal Weapons, so you don't even think of this one as a Christmas movie. At least Die Hard, the first two in the franchise both take place at Christmas. It's not just Die Hard 1 that's a Christmas movie. So out of the
Die Hard 2 is
out
also,
of the five Die Hard movies, 40% of them are Christmas movies, so it's easier to associate that one with Christmas than it is for Lethal Weapon, I think.
The Russian one also takes place during Christmas, doesn't it?
I think I've only seen that one once. But... So it's now the morning, and we are on a suburban street watching milk getting delivered to the Murtaugh household. Cut to the bathroom, where we meet a bearded Roger Murtaugh, played by Danny Glover, who has 203 credits. He's in all the Lethal Weapons, The Color Purple, Predator 2, the movie Mandela, where he played Nelson Mandela, which is a 1987 movie, not The Long Walk to Freedom, which stars Idris Elba in 2013. He's in Gone Fishing. And since 2000, he's kind of become more of a producer. He's got 46 producer credits.
Hmm.
So he's taking a bath. And
yeah.
We talked a bit in Bill and Ted's about what an odd choice jamming before school was. I feel the same way about bathing in the morning. I mean, part of the reason I shower is to help wake me up. But a bath, it just seems too cozy and relaxing in the morning. It's more of a nighttime thing.
I also like that that's your takeaway from the scene.
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, I like that that's your, not the fact that his family just barges in while he's buck naked.
You take a look at those bubbles. They are very sparing with the bubbles.
Well, see.
Yeah, they're not.
Yeah, that was my first takeaway from this. I feel like having a bath in the morning, there's just too much chance of falling asleep and drowning. But his bath, however, is interrupted when, yes, his family bursts in with a cake to sing him happy birthday because today is his big 5-0. Yeah, I'm glad that my son has never decided to celebrate any of my birthdays while I'm taking a bath.
Yeah, me too.
And Colin's reaction to this tells me that it's not a cultural thing. No, like, this is not a black family thing. Okay, so this is just bizarre altogether, then, the fact that they're singing happy birthday to him in the tub.
I will say that my actual initial takeaway from the scene before I realized the absurdity of it was that he has a full wall-sized mirror adjacent to the bathtub, and I think that is rad. I don't think I would ever get out of the bathtub if there was a wall-sized adjacent mirror. I'd just be too fascinated, like, looking at myself in the bathtub. It'd be great.
Oh, okay, then. Well, now I know what to get you for Christmas. Yeah. So, leading the pack of this group are his three kids, Nick, who's played by Damon Hines. He has 25 credits, only one since 2000. Carrie, who is played by Ebony Smith, who has 36 credits, nothing since 2002. And Rianne, who, my God, Rianne is hot. And I don't feel bad saying that because she was 27 when she filmed this movie. So damn, she's not actually 16 years old. But she is played by the lovely Tracy Wolf, who has only 7 credits, and 4 of those are Lethal Weapons. She was also in The Cosby Show, and then this year she was in an episode of a show called Katie Keene. It's her first credit since Lethal Weapon 4 in 1998. And also, of course, his wife Trisha Murtaugh, who is played by Darlene Love, who has 13 credits, 4 of which are Lethal Weapon. 4 are playing Darlene Love, and 2 are uncredited. She was actually more of a singer. She was a backup singer for many famous singers like Sam Cooke, Dionne Warwick, Bill Medley, The Beach Boys, Tom Jones, and Elvis. And so that's where a lot of her career is as a backup singer, which I found that interesting. I do appreciate the fact, though, that all of these people, as much as this didn't seem to start a huge career for them, that at least they all appear in all the sequels. They've never recast any of the kids. All of these kids, no matter how bit part they are, they're in all 4 Lethal Weapons, and I absolutely appreciate that.
They do also come off as a very real family. I've always thought the whole kissing your children on the lips thing was weird, and especially when your father is naked in the bathtub. But like, they do give off the vibe that they are very much a real family.
You know, I find that about all the dialogue in general in Lethal Weapon is just, it's very natural. It's very, there's just something that's very welcoming about all the dialogue, that you feel like you're living these lives with the people. It doesn't feel like it's script.
Yeah.
So yeah, Roger, celebrating Roger's birthday in the tub, and frankly, this is just weird, awkward, but it's a very jazzy happy birthday song, though. His daughter tells him the beard is looking gray and he should lose it. We cut over to a beach and we see a collie running towards a camper. This dog is played by Sam the Dog, whose IMDb shows 2 credits, this and Lethal Weapon 2. Yep, Sam the Dog has an IMDb page, and so does Murtaugh's cat, Burbank the Cat, who has the same 2 credits, Lethal Weapon 1 and Lethal Weapon 2. These animals have more IMDb credits than me! So, as I vented back in Demolition Man, if anyone knows a way to get my credit fixed on IMDb so that my credit shows properly, email us, I want to know. But the dog runs inside the camper, and we are introduced to the much different domestic life of Martin Riggs, played by Mel Gibson, who has Only 68 credits. I was surprised to see that Danny Glover had 208 compared to Mel Gibson's 68, but he was in Mad Max, Braveheart, Bird on a Wire, Air America, which gets mentioned in this movie, What Women Want, and all the Lethal Weapons. And it's just an interesting parallel is the fact that he's just as naked as Murtaugh when we meet him.
Yeah, that is true.
We meet both of these characters butt-ass naked.
I wonder what it means.
I don't know. But there's...
Die Hard what starts off with that dude naked doing Tai Chi in the hotel.
Oh, that's
room.
Die Hard 2, yeah.
Die Hard 2?
Yeah.
Something about 80s movies and naked dudes opening the movie.
That's right. all the full frontal in 80s, they needed to start showing some male asses. So, he, however, is alone, smoking, sleeping with a gun under his pillow, and having a beer to start his day. So, yeah, the other interesting parallel, apart from them being naked, is that as he's walking around his camper, Family Feud is playing on his TV. And now we head back to the Murtaugh household, where it's also playing on their TV. So they're watching the same show, even. Roger is now beard-free and getting ready to leave for work. Trisha passes on a phone message for Roger from someone named Michael Huntsucker. And because I'm a teenager at heart, my mind automatically went to this thought. What if he goes by Mike?
Mike Huntsucker.
Because now he's Mike Huntsucker.
Oh, Sean, you child.
So the name Huntsucker isn't one Roger has heard in a long time. Is it an old war buddy? Yeah, something like that. Murtaugh is called to the apparent suicide of a dead hooker, the one from the opening scene, Amanda Huntsucker. Odd coincidence that the daughter of his old friend that he hasn't heard from in a long time turns up dead. So he phones home to Trisha to get her to find Michael's number for him. We now go back to Riggs in a Christmas tree lot, slapped over the face.
By the way, it's a Christmas movie, in case you forgot.
In case you forgot. And he's in the middle of a drug deal. The bad guys tell him it's 100, so Riggs agrees. And the bad guys get excited that they've made this deal and say they'll throw in the best tree on the lot for free. And Riggs starts counting $100 from his wallet. I love it. No, it's $100,000. So Rig counters with him taking their coke and arresting them instead. They think the badge is fake, so he does his whole, "You want to see crazy? I'll show you crazy," and he pulls his gun. Then all hell breaks loose when a guy with a shotgun comes out from between the trees in the truck.
Yeah, just the whole time he was just chilling in the truck, I guess.
Yeah, I don't quite understand who he was and who he was going after. Because he shoots one of the bad guys? Or is it just because Riggs got out of the way in time?
I gotta say, this scene, when I watched it, I knew I was in for a treat that there was gonna be terrific action in this. Because Riggs jumps to his, like, belly just in the nick of time and then does a rolling maneuver as he just fires blindly ahead of him and kills not one, but two other men. It's great. Like, he just does a spin move where he just fires four bullets while he spins and just two men drop dead.
Well, he is a lethal weapon.
A lethal weapon. That was the dumbest line in the movie. For a movie that has some excellent, excellent quips, which I've wrote down a few that I really enjoyed, that was the dumbest line in the movie. We're going to have to get you registered as a lethal weapon, Riggs.
So all the bad guys die except one, who Riggs is pursuing through the tree lot. Riggs ends up getting taken hostage as he screams at his backup to shoot him. He doesn't care about his own safety. The bad guy ultimately gets apprehended, and we then see later that night where Riggs is at home and super suicidal, getting as far as a tear-filled gun in the mouth. Like you said, like, great performance from Mel Gibson, like the on-the-edge cop. You felt his pain.
Mm-hmm. From one great scene to another. That scene where he's shouting at the guy to shoot him and then asking the cops to shoot him and blah, blah, blah. And then following into that scene, like, they're both back-to-back fantastic scenes. Excellent performance from Mel.
And just shows just how much darker this movie is from the other ones are so much lighter. The sequels are so much lighter. You know, you bring in Joe Pesci, you bring in Chris Rock, all of a sudden you've got these movies that are just so much more levity to them. But in this scene, I also want to point out that there's a weird discrepancy with his TV, because when the scene starts, there's a Three Stooges movie starting, but when the scene ends with him taking the gun out of his mouth, there's a Bugs Bunny cartoon playing. And the interesting thing is Three Stooges is Columbia Pictures and Bugs Bunny is Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers is the company that does this movie, of course. But I think it's time for Sponsorship Corner!
Coming. So I was like, how has it not happened yet?
I know. The milk truck was one. I've already passed about four, but I decided I wanted to, you know, build some anticipation for this week's Sponsorship Corner. As always, I love looking for product placements in movies, and this is another big one. Lethal Weapon is brought to you by The Three Stooges and Looney Tunes, Family Feud, Rockview Farms, that's the milk truck in the beginning, GMC, Oldsmobile, and Ford Bronco, Ziploc sandwich bags, Norcold refrigerators, Purdue chicken, Coors beer, Sara Lee, Del Monte, Dove soap, Pam cooking spray, Pepsi Cola, Perrier water, Cost 103 FM, Pioneer Electronics, Alka-Seltzer, Ritz Co. Furniture, Shamrock Boats, Johnson Outboard Motors, Party Nog, and a Debbie Reynolds movie called Stargirl, and cocaine. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
People can't see it, but I love that as soon as you started, Chris just got up and like walked away. He's like, I got like five minutes here to get.
Yeah, he needed another beer.
It's gonna be a while before I can interject. I got time.
So the next day we get a brief exposition-y scene between Captain Ed Murphy, who's played by Steve Kahan. He has 41 credits. He was in Superman with Richard Donner, Predator 2 with Danny Glover, Maverick and Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson, and Demolition Man, apparently. Plus, he's in all the Lethal Weapons. Yeah, I actually looked up the Demolition Man credit, and the screenshot is he's one of the guys in the beginning there when he blows up the first building. Okay. He's one of the cops that's down on the road waiting for him. Mm. Or maybe even one of the ones that was in the archive videos. Huh. But, yeah, I had no idea to look for him. So he's discussing Riggs' sanity with the station psychologist Stephanie Woods, who is played by one of our favorites, Mary Ellen Trainer, Mrs. Walsh from the Goonies, and Mom from the Monster Squad as well, and of course Die Hard and all the Lethal Weapons. The psychologist thinks that Riggs isn't fit for duty, but the captain disagrees and loses her in the men's room. Great way to get rid of Mrs. Walsh. We're now in Murtaugh's office while he's having a chat with one of the other cops who's talking about being an 80s man because he cried last night. Were you with a woman? No. Why do you think I was crying?
Excellent.
He also gets the toxicology report about Amanda's case and finds out she was actually poisoned. So even if she hadn't jumped, she would have died anyway. And also that he's being assigned a new partner that day. So the whole time he's getting this information, he's keeping an eye on the suspicious Riggs that he sees sitting outside his office. And Riggs pulls out his gun casually. Murtaugh panics and tackles him. Gun! But Riggs comes out on top, and the captain says, Rog, meet your new partner. And we get Roger dropping his first, I'm getting too old for this shit of the movie.
The first of many. I didn't expect him to say it multiple times. Like, very much becomes a cliche in this movie, not only, like, other movies.
Well, it was at this point that I decided I wanted to keep a I'm getting too old for this shit tally, and it's actually only 2.5 in this movie.
2.5.
Two and a half. Because one of them is, I'm too old for this. That's all he says. So it's like,
a half.
Yeah, that's the half.
This definitely seems like an overreaction on the veteran cop Murtaugh's part. I doubt that's the first time. Mel Gibson definitely comes off as a shady character, somebody that doesn't look like they belong in that precinct atmosphere for sure. But it can't be the first time a detective's pulled out their weapon to look at it or inspect it or something like that.
Yeah, but he doesn't look like a cop. I mean,
fair enough.
He's got a tattoo.
A special ops tattoo, though.
That's right. So Riggs and Murtaugh are now walking to their car in the parkade discussing their guns. Roger is old school with his six-shooter, Murtaugh has been reading Riggs's file, knows that he's an ex-Army Ranger and trained in martial arts, and we're going to have to register you as a lethal weapon. He said it. Riggs says, let's cut the shit. We know why I got transferred. We now get a quick summary of Riggs's backstory. Everyone thinks I'm suicidal, so I'm fucked and no one wants to work with me. Or they think I'm faking to draw a psycho pension, so I'm fucked and no one will work with me. Basically, I'm fucked. And we get the response from Roger. Oh, guess what? I don't want to work with you. We're both fucked.
This movie is rated R, just by the way.
because the scenes where you're not seeing Christmas stuff, you're still reminded
you're
that
you're seeing all of the rated R things in between the Christmas segments, yes.
We cut to a seedy-looking warehouse where we meet Mr. Joshua, famous crazy person Gary Busey, who was in Under Siege, Point Break, Predator 2 with Danny Glover, and was nominated for an Oscar when he played Buddy Holly in the Buddy Holly story back in 1978. And of course, as I mentioned in our Police Academy episode, Days, Volume 2, set in context, nonsense, I'm still hoping that someone will find me a copy of that movie. He is escorting Mendez to see his boss about drugs. They go through the really bizarre area, like this weird seedy warehouse type bathroom looking, I don't know, it looks like the set of Saw.
All of the bad guy sets in this movie are definitely one of the first movies to do it, so it's not a cliche, but it seems like such a cliche. There's pipes that are smoking and it's a random warehouse that has a drip somewhere in it. There's puddles everywhere for some reason,
but then they come out into this club that doesn't fit with it at all. So he meets the boss, General Peter McAllister, who is played by Mitchell Ryan, who has 137 credits. His first credit was 1958 in a movie called Thunder Road. He was in Gross Point Blank. He was in Liar Liar. He was in Dharma and Greg. And he played Hugh Hefner in a 1981 movie, Death of a Centerfold, the Dorothy Stratton story.
I also love that in keeping with our Christmas theme, his name is Peter McAllister, which is the father of Kevin McAllister in Home Alone.
And I, holy shit.
It opened my mind to this potential like movie crossover universe where Peter McAllister on the side of like just leaving his child alone once a year also runs some heroin drug smuggling operation.
Or we could like just make it up, like we could just make it headcanon that Peter McAllister, Kevin McAllister's dad, is actually Peter McAllister Jr.
Yeah.
And so this is actually Kevin's grandfather.
Oh yeah.
So so this Mendez guy, of course, is being a bit of an ass. And, you know, saying about Mr. Joshua, where'd you get him? Psychos are us. Huh? I'm from New York, right?
This scene has one of my favorite quips of the movie.
Oh, which was?
You guys are out there like fucking Pluto, man.
You're out like fucking Pluto, man. Yeah, I have that one written down as well. Yeah, they didn't know that Pluto wasn't going to be a planet anymore. Ha ha. Joke's on you, 1987.
Damn. So foolish of them.
So the general uses Mr. Joshua burning his arm to intimidate him into agreeing to the deal.
That scene looks pretty real. Like there was a part where they start the scene where it's like definitely him holding it a little bit in front of the flame, but there was a scene where they cut like an underneath
the close
shot
up
that looked
of the forearm.
Very, very real.
Yeah. We go back to Roger, who is meeting with Michael Huntsucker, who is played by Tom Atkins, who was in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, The Fog, Night of the Creeps, lots of TV. His first credit is The Doctors in 1963. So he's meeting with Michael while Riggs waits outside. Roger explains that Michael's daughter was murdered, and Michael wants Roger to kill them all. Kill them all! You owe me, Roger! Kill those bastards! Riggs and Murtaugh take a call to respond to a jumper on a building, and we get some fun Riggs stuff here where he acts like a kid wanting to turn on the siren when he gets in the car. Can we turn on the siren?
Acts like he hasn't been a cop for multiple years at this point.
Right? So Riggs goes up on the roof to deal with it, and in this scene you can actually see Richard Donner's Winnebago parked below on the street, which is also something you can see in a scene in The Goonies, which is something I didn't mention back in that episode, way back in episode number one. He is known to use his Winnebago instead of a hotel while filming. So in this scene you can see it down parked on the street.
Interesting. Part of the craft, I guess.
Riggs gets out on the ledge with the jumper, and using a cigarette as a distraction, he handcuffs himself to the jumper. He thinks they're done here. Time to go in. If you jump now, you're a murderer. But when the guy resists, Riggs amps up his crazy and suicidal tendencies, and he eggs the guy on to jump, and he pulls the guy off the ledge and jumps. And we get a handcuff blooper that has always bothered me, because these two stunt guys jump off the edge of the ledge, and they were probably instructed to hold hands as they jump, and they let go of their hands, and you can tell that they're actually not handcuffed to each other. Like, it was, they didn't actually handcuff the stunt guys together for safety. But here you can see that, whoops, they fucked it up.
Also, miraculous street-sized stunt pads set up in a matter of seconds. I get that they're LAPD, so Hollywood, you know, those are kicking around every corner or whatever. But still, like, to get that set up so quickly.
Oh, yeah, like, because the guy keeps looking down at the street, and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden there's this big airbag there.
And Murtaugh, standing in the street, thinks that Riggs is a goner as he jumps. Like, obviously he didn't look down, I guess. He was so enthralled.
Forward.
He was so enthralled by Riggs falling through the air that he forgot to look at the ground and see the giant, giant pad that had been set up in like a matter of seconds. But, you know.
And you would have heard that filling, too.
Yeah. A lot of things wrong with that scene, but anyways.
So Murtaugh starts losing his shit on Riggs and pulls him into a nearby building to yell at him. Riggs has a death wish. Do you want to die? Yeah, I've got a special bullet for the occasion. Hollow point. Well, why not do it now? You can use my gun. And we get this like really tense moment where Riggs actually does pull the trigger, but Murtaugh manages to stop it just in time by getting his hand in the way of the hammer on the gun. And he says, you're not trying to collect psycho pension. You really are crazy.
Also, Murtaugh's eyes during that scene, like, he also, gotta say, Donald Glover gives a very excellent performance, or Danny Glover gives an excellent performance.
Because, yeah, not Childish Gambino.
Sorry, yeah, my bad. Danny Glover gives an excellent performance because during that scene, like, he doesn't really say much, but, like, tells you everything with just his facial expressions. That, like, crazy eye that he gives when he realizes that Riggs is definitely just going to pull the trigger is excellent.
Yeah. So now they're on their way to a suspect's house, but not before Roger pulls over to make a phone call to the psychologist. My girlfriend at this point, when we looked at the phone, like the quote unquote portable phone that he has with this
in the
giant
suitcase, right?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. My girlfriend looked at me and said, well, he might as well have just stopped at a payphone if he's pulling over with this enormous phone.
He also doesn't dial a number when he picks up the phone.
But, well, he's already on the phone call, though.
Oh, I think there's another part where he doesn't dial the number before he picks up the phone and says hello. Because I remember seeing a scene where he does that and I went like, he didn't dial anything. Like, is this Siri? Is this 1987 Siri? He just opens it and goes, hello, operator. Connect me to...
I don't know. Now, I'm no expert on doctor-patient confidentiality, but should she be divulging information about a patient? Like, she already told the captain, but that's okay. That's his boss, but she's just on the phone telling Roger everything that's wrong with Riggs. But they get to the suspect's house, and they're invited onto the property by some woman on a scooter, so we don't need a warrant, I guess. They stumble across a coke operation going on with women in, like, scantily clad outfits, or were they even in bikinis?
I think it was scantily clad.
Yeah, they're in, like, these, like, laced, like, weird fishnet tops almost.
Yeah.
But also, ballsy of them to be doing all of that coke business in front of, like, a wall-sized window.
So they get ambushed by some guys with guns, and they kill them all, have a showdown with one last guy who they've wounded, but he pulls a gun. Riggs shoots him a couple times. He falls into the covered pool.
This part, when I was watching it, this stunt, whoever did it, props to him. That is a legit terrifying stunt. Like, he is just wrapped up by whatever that plastic is. Like, that is suffocating after you get out of the pool and drowning while you're in the pool. Like, that is a very scary stunt.
Yeah, very. Riggs and Murtaugh jump in to try to save him, but ultimately they end up with no suspect to question because they've killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, these two men are buddies, and Murtaugh decides to invite Riggs home for dinner. Like, it's a very quick switch in their relationship, an immediate switch in their relationship.
This is also the first day they've met.
Yep.
You ever meet a coworker and invite them over for dinner the first day you meet them?
Nope.
Nah.
But yeah, he does. He invites him over for dinner. And luckily, Trish has plenty to accommodate this guest. And Roger promptly insults her cooking to Riggs. And through dinner...
It's the 80s, baby.
His oldest daughter, Rianne, is dreamily watching Riggs. A little creepy if she wasn't 27 when this movie was filmed.
Yeah, shocking to learn that she's 27, right? She really does look like a 16-year-old.
Born in 1960.
See, I felt the opposite. I thought she was, like, in college.
Yeah.
I didn't realize she was that young in the movie.
Maybe I've got the age wrong. Like, maybe she is only, you know, maybe she's supposed to be playing 18 or 19. I could be wrong on that. If she's college age, then Roger is very overprotective of this daughter, then.
I'm just thinking, like, later on, when she gets captured and she's, like, kind of hooked up to that one thing and she's handcuffed and stuff and...
Yeah.
That old dude, that if she's that young, it makes that scene where that old dude is kind of talking about how, like, good looking she is a little bit more creepy.
Yeah, let's say that she's 18. I like that.
She's college age.
I feel better about that.
Can we go back and edit the beginning of this?
No.
No.
After dinner, they're out in the driveway on Murtaugh's boat, drinking beer, bonding, and discussing the case. Riggs is heading home for the night, drunk. Before he drives away, Murtaugh asks him if he really likes his wife's cooking. No, Raj, I don't. Back in the house, Murtaugh has received some evidence, which is a class of 1983 yearbook and a porno, which both have Amanda Huntsucker in them. The next morning, Riggs wakes up a slightly hungover Roger.
Wait. We cannot... Just wait.
Okay.
This is the part where, like, Murtaugh starts watching the video, right? This is that part?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like... I didn't understand why he would watch this video.
Yeah, thank
you. Knowing that, okay, there's two things I have to say. First, I didn't understand why he would watch this video knowing that this is, like, his friend's daughter, who he presumably kind of watched grow up, it seemed he was involved in her life. And then
very involved,
It's not like the video has any evidence. Like, it's not like this video was taken the night she died or anything.
It's not
going to
crack the case.
Yeah, why does he keep watching it is the better question. That's true.
His background noise.
But how much did he watch this girl grow up, though? If, I'm not trying to justify it too much, but, like, really, how much has he watched this girl grow up if his wife has never even heard the name Michael Huntsucker?
Fair enough.
I would remember a name like Mike Cunsucker.
Yeah.
But Mike Cunsucker, he talks about how he was, like, basically Murtaugh was like an uncle figure to her in a way.
Oh, okay.
Because they were war buddies whatever they were.
So just because Trish never met him doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so that's my point number one.
Yep, okay.
Okay, my second point was the way that this sequence is shot, I thought they were going to do a similar thing how they do at the beginning where they kind of, like, zoom in on a TV in Murtaugh's house and then zoom out at Riggs's house.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but I fully thought they were going to go into the porno with start with Murtaugh watching it and then zoom out and have Riggs watching it. And I was just like... I was like, that's so nasty.
Yeah, considering what we know Riggs' home life to be like, I don't think I want to see him sitting around watching porn.
Yeah.
Also, you clarified this scene for me, because when they started to bro down in the boat, I definitely took a time to, like, check my phone or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I looked up, I just saw Murtaugh looking through a yearbook and watching porn, and I was very, very weirded out by it. Plus, it also said that it was class of 83, and I went... That couldn't be his yearbook, right? Because he's 50 or whatever. But yeah, I'm glad you clarified that scene for me. It definitely puts a couple puzzle pieces into place. Yeah.
So the next morning, Riggs wakes up a slightly hungover Roger in bed with a cup of coffee. he's a very different kind of guy, and he's been thinking about the case all night.
I would have loved it if the scene opened with just some, like, tissues next to, like...
Oh, no! Oh, boy. So Roger goes to shower. So they do have a shower, which makes the bath extra weird.
Uh-huh.
Their conversation continues in a shooting range, which is a very unusual choice of a venue.
I have it written down, gun range detectives. Why is that the place that you do your meetings about your detection work?
Yeah, with your loud noises and your big headphones.
your muffs on, yeah.
They decide that they need to question Dixie the hooker that witnessed the suicide because there are inconsistencies with her story. I did a bullet count here, just like I did with Police Academy. Let's hope I got this one a bit better. Both emptied their guns, and so if you count the holes in their targets, 16 for Riggs and 6 for Roger, so that count is fine. However, it is hard to tell with sounds, but the actual shots you see are only 9 for Riggs and 1 for Roger. So I don't know how many of those other gun sound effects that are firing are supposed to be for Roger, but they sound so much more distant than their own sound effects do. So there may be an inconsistency with the amount of shots they actually take.
Well, I counted for, I think it's the second, when they have their like shoot-off where Riggs makes the smiley face and that one added up.
Then they decide to have a shooting competition. So just what Colin mentioned here, Murtaugh goes first. He moves the target about a third of the way down the range, does his neck roll thing, taking aim, and takes a shot right in the center of the head. And then Riggs puts the same target back on the track and sends it all the way down to the fucking end. But a very fun scene. Like, I love how he's just
I like that it
humming
lingers.
Yeah, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And the way that, like, he moves his position so that you can't actually see the joke before they have a chance to reveal it. But yeah, he ends up taking several shots, brings it back, and he's turned Murtaugh's shot into a happy face with the line, "Have a nice day." So they arrive at Dixie's to question her amid the chants of a group of kids saying, "You're gonna bust Dixie." As they walk up the path, boom! The house fucking explodes. Riggs' jacket is on fire, and Murtaugh gets on top of him to put it out, to which Riggs' reaction is, "What are you, a fag? Get off me!"
Yeah, I have that circled on my page.
So, 1987 pulls out another one.
That's not even the best one. I didn't notice that one until I watched it the second time around, but later on when Riggs is getting electrocuted, that's where the money is.
With Al Leong? Yeah, I've got that one in my notes coming up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The kids all want them to do it again, do it again.
The kids are an excellent touch to this scene,
I
do have to
say. The kids are amazing.
It's great.
Yeah. In the aftermath, when more cops and firefighters have shown up, Riggs has found pieces of the detonator and says he hasn't seen work like this since the war. A real pro job.
Yeah, it's a mercury-timed switch, which is like a, it's just a random timer, which is, it's very coincidental that as they walk up to the house explodes.
Well, but thermostats, like old school thermostats use mercury switches, so there might have been something, I don't know, the way they make it sound is that he's set it up to the gas line, so maybe he's actually wired it right in. So that this mercury switch tips,
it's still coincidental that it happens as they walk up to the house.
Absolutely. So Roger and Riggs question the kids because one of the other cops says they saw someone creeping around earlier outside Dixie's house. The real hero witness is 6-year-old Alfred wearing his 3D glasses.
Which, by the way, in 1987, are there a lot of 3D movies?
I think about the fact that I had 3D comics.
Okay.
So that might have been what it was for.
Because at first I thought they were x-ray specs.
Yeah.
But it does say 3D on the side.
It does say 3D on the side. Alfred enlightens them that his mom says, "Cops shoot black people."
And they quickly pivot by asking if the kids want ice cream.
Yeah.
Very quickly pivot.
Yeah. Oh, except for you, Alfred. But I do love the kids where it's like, don't tell them your name. Yeah, don't tell them your name, Alfred. Like, they're 6-year-olds. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The biggest clue is that the man he saw was white, tall, and had a tattoo exactly like Riggs, which I must note is a very small tattoo to be seen from across the street.
Also, one hell of another coincidence.
That's true.
That the responding officer has the exact same tattoo as the potential suspect.
Mm-hmm. But I think about the fact that my tattoos take up my entire shoulders, and from across the street, you probably wouldn't be able to tell what they actually are.
And it just looked like colors, probably, yeah.
Yeah. But I guess in 1987, tattoos were also a lot more rare, but still, it's tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this information has narrowed down the suspects because, well, it is a special forces tattoo. They end up back talking to Michael Huntsucker at his house during Amanda's funeral. Roger has drawn the conclusion that there's a bigger conspiracy and Huntsucker is mixed up in some dirty shit and his daughter was killed because of his business. Michael tells him all about a CIA front called Air America and how it was used for drug smuggling. His confession is rewarded with him getting assassinated by Mr. Joshua from a helicopter, gets shot right in the back and through the eggnog that he's holding. Riggs tries to shoot the helicopter down as it flies away, empties two clips. But, you know, after seeing that scene of him in the range, it's like, he could actually fucking do this.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I wonder if that was the point, to just make it a little bit believable.
Oh, but I love that range scene, though. It's so funny. But, yeah, it sets up this fact that you look at how ridiculous it is that he's shooting at this.
It's like, no, he's a crack shot.
Yeah, he's good.
He talks about how in the Special Forces he made a shot that was over 1,000 yards.
Yeah.
Which is, that's 10 football fields, yeah. You imagine seeing somebody at the end of 10 football fields, probably look like a dot.
Yeah, you look like a dot at the end of one football field.
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, he empties two clips at the helicopter. Joshua calls it in to the general and tells him that Huntsucker was talking to the cops. So later, Riggs is out questioning hookers on the street when he takes a shotgun to the chest in a drive-by by Mr. Joshua and flies through a nearby window. Luckily, he was wearing a vest.
While questioning hookers, I'm so glad I put on my bulletproof vest.
That's right. Now I'm pissed, Roger. But they realize that they can use this to their advantage because now the bad guys thinks Riggs is a corpse. Turns out Riggs isn't the only one targeted because on the radio they hear of a disturbance near Murtaugh's house involving a suspect that sounds like Rianne's date. This date of hers, because we never actually meet this boyfriend or whatever or whoever he is, was she catfished by Mr. Joshua or something?
It sounds like it.
Because, like, it's the suspect that looks like her date. I'm just wondering what it is about the fact that he hears on the radio that the suspect sounds like Rianne's date that makes him drive home, and then it ends up being Mr. Joshua has, like, kidnapped Rianne. Like, I don't understand the motivation to go home for this boyfriend, and then it turns into something more sinister. That's why I'm wondering, was she catfished?
Also, the vague description of a suspect makes him think of the date that his daughter briefly described to him.
Oh, yeah, and it was like 3 blocks away from his house even. Like,
yeah.
It wasn't even his address. Yeah, they go back to the Murtaugh house, and they find out Rianne has been kidnapped. Trish is losing it, of course, and the guys at the precinct are in on the ruse of Riggs' fake death when Mr. Joshua phones pretending to be media, which is very clever on the bad guy's part, and the police make a statement that Riggs was shot and killed in the line of duty, which was even more clever on the part of the cops. So way to go, LAPD.
Fictional LAPD.
The bad guys have called with their meeting location, Dry Lake, Victorville, Sunrise tomorrow. So Riggs and Murtaugh come up with a plan, and it gets real intense for a minute with Riggs saying, "I won't miss, and we're going to get bloody on this one, Roger." Sunrise comes, and Riggs and Murtaugh are in the middle of nowhere. Roger stops briefly to drop off a khaki-clad sniper rifle-toting Riggs, who runs off to hide in the brush and take up a sniper position as Roger continues on to the meeting point. We get a lot of epic camera work here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Richard Donner must have gotten a discount on helicopters with that opening tracking shot, and now this. But this scene is just so drawn out.
Also, just a huge desert.
Yep.
What's up with that? Is there a desert outside of L.A. that I'm not aware of?
This is, you know, well, yeah, yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Well, Nevada.
Yeah.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah, no.
It's not right outside of
yeah,
L.A.
Yeah, but it's Las Vegas is only like 2 hours away from
It's like
Los
Calgary
Angeles.
From Los Angeles.
Yeah. And so it turns to desert pretty fast. But this is the kind of area that the Mythbusters like to use for a lot of their testing. Or when you see people setting land speed records or something, it's usually on desert flats like this in California.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if that scene, like just the way it's shot with Murtaugh looking out at all these vehicles, it was very Road Warrior-esque. And I was wondering if maybe that they were like... If that was like a subtle callback to Mel Gibson.
A little winking and thumbs up to the camera for Mel Gibson there.
That's also definitely like a setup stereotype now, a character standing in a desert watching a convoy of different types of vehicles roll up to him.
Yeah, because we have a limo, a truck, and a very, very low-flying helicopter.
Very low-flying.
Why are you so low, helicopter?
Like maybe 10 feet above the car that it's following.
Yeah, and it doesn't even do like a proper sweep of the area, which is probably why you brought a helicopter with you in the first place.
Yeah, to get an aerial view.
But yeah, this scene is just, you watch them drive in for like 5 minutes
with constant cutbacks to Danny Glover.
Yeah,
looking way too old for this shit.
Wait, yeah, because now he's got all this dust in his hair, so now he's extra gray. So
and
yes,
he's extra sweaty because he's standing in a suit in the middle of the desert.
So Roger and the bad guys are negotiating the exchange of Roger for his daughter. Roger pulls out a grenade, saying to do it his way, or we all die. How powerful is a grenade?
Yeah, I think he might have gotten the two closest people standing to him, unless he threw it. But definitely Gary Busey standing over by the car is totally fine.
Yep.
Also, he's going up against military people. Like, would they not just know to, like, just grab it and push the pin back in? Or I just feel like grenades are generally kind of scary when you're dealing with the layman, but I feel like if they're all soldiers, they would have seen it before.
They would have known the blast radius of a grenade.
Yeah,
first
Mr. Joshua
all.
Just keeps walking towards him like he doesn't give a shit. But yeah, that grenade would take out, what, like 3-4 people tops?
I mean,
unless
you
got it under a car.
I've never thrown a grenade, but I can't imagine it being that big of an explosion. It's a very small package.
Yeah. It's also kind of hilarious that after Murtaugh does get shot and he throws the grenade, it appears that he only throws it a maximum of about 6 feet, not at the large group of people that are probably 20 to 30 feet away.
But is that because of the fact that this grenade ends up being a smoker? Like, it's just a distraction so that Riggs can start shooting people. Which he does. All hell breaks loose. Roger tells Rianne to run. Bad guys are dying. Rianne is trying to flee in the limo. The helicopter is chasing her dangerously low, nudging it with its rudders.
Depending on her age, this scene is very, very, very actually, not even depending on her age. This scene is traumatic. She watches multiple people die around her. She has to push a dead body out of the way of a wheel of a car so that she can get away. And then she's chased by a helicopter. Like, this is terrible. Terrifying for a young girl to experience.
Families of cops should not be this immersed in their dad's job. But yeah, I just don't understand the helicopter nudging the limo. But she ends up crashing, and Riggs gets captured by General McAllister, the head of Shadow Company.
Captured for some reason.
The numbers eventually overwhelm Murtaugh, and everyone gets captured. So we cut to Riggs, shirtless and strung up for torture with water pouring on him. And he says, I imagine this is the line you were talking about. Who's the chin? Is that the one?
Yeah, that. Are you purposely not saying the word? Not that I will.
No, he says chin. No, he said chin. Who's the chin?
Does he?
Oh, there was no K on the end of that. Yeah.
Are you sure?
I had subtitles on and everything. Yeah, he says who's the chin.
Okay. I thought for sure there was.
So you thought it was worse. There's no K on the end. No. No, but they got away with Mike Huntsucker. So who's the chin, Riggs asks of the new person in the room. Well, it's Endo, played by Al Leong, who we remember as Genghis Khan in Bill and Ted's. He has 72 credits, 16 of which are uncredited. He was in Double Dragon, which I watched for the first time earlier this year. What a piece of shit that is.
I love that movie as a kid.
Alyssa Milano is still hot, though. But yeah, he's in Die Hard, Big Trouble in Little China, and interestingly was in Lethal Weapon 4 as well as a triad member.
As a different character.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep. He's there to give him a little zappy zap torture.
Yeah, initially I thought he was having boiling water poured on him. I didn't understand the random pouring of water until I finally saw the zoom in on the car battery.
Yeah.
It was very, very confusing for me initially.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in another room, Murtaugh is tied to a chair, being beat up and having salt rubbed into his gunshot wound. Twice in this scene, he tells them to go spit. Is that a thing?
I can't say it's a thing.
I feel like I've heard the spit used as like a derogatory expression, but It's of a time.
Yeah, he says it with such intensity, you know, go spit. Their torture isn't working, so they bring in Rianne and threaten her instead. General McAllister tells Murtaugh there are no heroes left in the world when, ba-ba-ba-ba, a perfectly timed entrance of the freshly escaped Riggs as he bursts through the door with the body of Endo on his shoulders, which he throws at one guy and ends up killing nearly everyone, and then chasing Joshua and McAllister through the club in front of this warehouse. I still don't get this back room. Mr. Joshua drives away with Riggs in pursuit, sprinting after him. I'm sure he's running fast, but are you going to catch a car?
No. There is one scene where he takes off with quite impressive speed, though. I will give him that. He is a very fast runner, at least for the few seconds he's on screen, sprinting as fast as he can.
But he even takes like an extra 5 seconds to make sure Roger is okay, who tells him to keep going. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can head him off on the bridge. It's like, well, how do you know that's where he was going, Roger? But somehow he manages to, shooting him with an assault rifle, but ultimately he loses him. Murtaugh, meanwhile, goes after McAllister. He tries to run Roger down in his car, but Roger stands his ground, does his neck roll sharpshooter thing, and shoots the driver, who flips the car, and General McAllister is stuck in the car with a bunch of grenades and gets blown up. See, a bunch of grenades! That's going to be a big explosion.
Uh-huh.
One grenade, that's nothing, Roger.
Also, cars love to explode in this movie.
Yeah.
I think this is one of, like, three cars that just randomly explode.
Well, this one's got to be because
of
the grenades.
This one's justified. This one is a justified explosion. Yeah. I will give you that. But yeah, also I want to say, like, the stunts in this movie are just great. Like, all of them through and through are great. Like, this one where the car is flipped by a bus and then explodes, like, they legitimately did that. Like, it's very
effects.
Very good looking.
They now come to the realization that, oh shit, Joshua knows where Roger lives. Back at Roger's house, we see Joshua break into the Murtaugh household to find a note attached to the Christmas tree. Remember, it's Christmas, kids.
Yeah, by the way.
That says, "Dear bad guys, no one here but us cops. Sorry. Sincerely, the good guys." But while he's reading the note, a cop car crashes through the front fucking window of the house.
Fuck it. Why not?
Mr. Joshua is captured, but instead of taking him away normally, they decide to let Riggs and Joshua have a fist fight on the front lawn instead.
This is my favorite part of the movie. It is excellent. The fact that they forego all professionalism to have Riggs beat the shit out of the criminal on the front lawn while a fire hydrant is exploding.
But they like to point out the fact that they know that this is not normal police procedure, because Murtaugh is like, no, stay back. He just killed one of our...
I'll take the heat of it.
Yeah, I'll take the heat. Well, he just killed one of our officers. But
this is why people wanted to become cops in the 80s. I feel like if I would have watched Lethal Weapon, I would have wanted to become a cop.
My second favorite quip of the entire movie happens right before this scene, right before Riggs fights Gary Busey, and "Would you like a shot at the title?"
Yeah.
And then they just start going at it. Well, they start fighting.
My girlfriend said to me, "What title? Like, is this something? Like, is this back in his army days or something?" I'm like, "No, he's just like it's
you
just
a piece
alive.
Of me.
Yeah,
you want a shot at the title.
Death by stereo."
Yeah, I love that too. I also thought that, to go on along with what you were saying before, it's odd to me that, like, what was the end game? You could have just... Well, I guess it's more... I was telling my wife, it's more along these lines. So, like, at the end of the fight, obviously, like, Riggs chokes him out using jiu-jitsu, which I feel like jiu-jitsu wasn't very well known at that time.
But he does know martial arts. Like, it says in his file.
Excellent armbar. Very, very good performance.
Yeah. Yeah, like, now jiu-jitsu is huge because of the UFC, but before, it would have very much been limited to military use, so that it is cool that they added that. But then, like, after he chokes him out with the triangle and Gary Busey, Mr. Joshua, gets back up and grabs the gun, they kill him.
Yeah.
So
it's like a callback to the pool scene.
Yeah. But I just want to put, he didn't have to die.
Yeah.
They had a clean arrest. You know what I mean? Like, what the Inquisition that should occur after this is all said and done and they have their Christmas dinner should solely rest on the fact that this man did not have to die.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And the And I'm just saying, the age of like police brutality and all this stuff, yeah. Like
internal affairs should be all over this
there,
shit.
There yeah. are a yeah. gajillion cops and a helicopter watching this fight play out on the front line, and the whole time Murtaugh is going, "No, this is Riggs' arrest. Don't get involved. This is Riggs' arrest."
I know.
And they're all just watching him beat the shit out of this guy. Like, they could intervene at any point, but they let him pull a gun and let them shoot him to death.
And Murtaugh at one point is like, I'll vouch for him. And I'm like,
yeah, yeah. He says that a bunch of times. He's like, I'll take the heat, I'll vouch for him.
Vouch for yeah. what? And then you, also,
you should be fired.
There's a brief point where Riggs is about to get drowned in a puddle. And he's yeah. like, Murtaugh's like, why didn't somebody, it's like hockey fight. Oh, it's yeah. like hockey
you,
fight.
Do you want me to step in? Yeah, do you want me yeah. to step
he's
in?
He's like, let me help you. And he goes, no.
Well, see, and Murtaugh even provides an assist at one point, because we get to the point where Joshua gets this oh, big yeah. fucking yeah. pole from
huge
somewhere.
Gangly pole.
And Murtaugh's like, Riggs, here, and tosses him a nightstick.
Someone get him a nightstick.
But man, he makes that nightstick look badass. Like,
oh yeah, the block.
You know, before this, you know, just in life, I wondered, like, what is the point of a nightstick? How, like, what a stupid fucking weapon. And then you see him use it in this, and he's using it to block, and he's like just kicking ass with a nightstick. It's like, oh, that's a pretty badass weapon.
Well, nightsticks are pretty solid. You ever held a nightstick?
Those no,
are,
I actually
surprisingly
never have.
Surprisingly heavy.
Yeah, and yeah, just like you said, just like a hockey fight, keep fighting.
Yeah, just keep going.
It actually reminded me a lot of the fight between Simon Phoenix and John Spartan in Demolition
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Like, it's very reminiscent of that. Mm-hmm. Or I should say, Demolition Man is very reminiscent of this.
Well, and one of my favorite bits as well is the fact that Riggs busts out a Karate Kid style train kick at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
it was excellent.
That's a thing, I guess. So yeah, Riggs comes out on top of this fight. I should also mention, I love the fact that they're lighting this scene with the helicopter.
Yeah.
That is a very cool directorial choice in this scene. But yeah, Riggs comes out on top. He doesn't kill Joshua, though. And Murtaugh tells the other cops, get this shit off my lawn. Mm-hmm. And then we get the action movie cliche of the last minute bad guy pop up with a gun. And Riggs and Murtaugh take him out. And it's very much like the end of Die Hard. Very action cliche. So
it's also super fortunate that that fire hydrant was there. Like, I don't know if this scene is as cool
without
the water just spraying.
I thought it was
possible drowning. Yeah.
I thought it was just raining until I remembered that the cop was shot and that he crashed into the, like, it's cool that it still played a part in the eventual fight scene.
Yeah. And combined with that helicopter lighting, like it does have this very ghostly effect to it. It's kind of like a crow like scene, you know?
Yeah.
It's also hilarious that the cops set up a perimeter so that this fight can play out. Yeah. They actually say to themselves, like, make sure that no civilian can get in, make a perimeter around them so this can play out.
So after our fight, we get our denouement of the movie, starting with a scene of Riggs all scarred and cut up on his face, who's visiting his wife's grave, having an emotional moment. He misses her, but he's not ready to join her yet.
And this time it's legitimately raining
yeah.
because he's supposed to
I
be
know.
Sad.
Yeah. It's raining. It's like an obscene amount of rain.
It's just as much rain as the fire hydrant. It's,
yeah.
It's
why do movies
level.
Always have rain during funerals or rain in graveyards? Like, you
it
know,
just
people.
I was watching.
My grandfather's funeral was a sunny day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, have you ever just stood in the rain?
Yeah,
without an umbrella and just got so soaking wet that your hair is dripping and your clothes are sopping? Like, would you not just be like, hey, maybe it's raining outside, maybe I'll come back yeah, another day?
The worst rainstorm I've ever endured, I had to walk through like 15 minutes of it, and it's like I jumped in a pool. And I could, that's every Hollywood movie rain scene ever.
That yeah. rain that we had in Florida was pretty bad.
Well, yeah, that's definitely one of the worst
yeah,
ones.
Yeah, Chris and I went to Disney World way back to celebrate. Was it your 13th birthday? Maybe your 12th birthday? So. We happened to be there during a hurricane.
Hurricane season, at least, yeah.
Yeah, Hurricane Irene happened while we were there.
Right, yeah.
And so there was one day at one of the parks, and the sky just opened up.
Yeah.
Yeah, 5 minutes in the rain, we were just drenched. And we were miserable for the rest of the day. And, like, my feet were sore.
Yeah, came home, take off the shoes, and your feet are, like, purple. Just, yeah. And they look like they have bags tied around them.
Yeah.
So now, Riggs, after saying goodbye to his wife, or I guess not goodbye, but let her know that he's not ready to die yet.
Also, does a terrible job of cleaning all the leaves off of her tombstone. He takes a good few circle swipes at it, and still, at the end scene when they zoom in on the tomb, there's still a leaf on it. So, I mean, not to diss Mel Gibson or Riggs the character, but I could do a better job of cleaning off a tombstone. I mean, come on.
But he set that American flag back up properly, so.
Thank God.
We're good, yeah.
USA, USA.
America! So he then goes to Roger's house to give him a present, and it's his special suicide bullet with a bow around it.
What a gift.
Rianne answers the door. He gives it to her and tells her to give it to her dad. I don't need this anymore. She invites him in, but he says, nah, Merry Christmas, and starts to leave. Roger catches up to him as he's heading to his truck, insists he comes in for dinner.
By the way, he whistles for his dog, and it jumps out the car, which means that he left his car door cracked open, went to the house, and just left it cracked open just in case he was invited in so he could whistle for his dog, and then didn't go back to close the door of his car.
That's a good point.
He just left it open in suburban Los Angeles.
Yeah. And so we get sound effects of dogs chasing the cat, and we get Elvis singing I'll Be Home for Christmas, and we get Roger
Christmas
Murtaugh
movie,
chasing and we get Roger Murtaugh fixing a burnt out bulb on his Christmas lights, and credits that dedicate the movie to Dar Robinson, stuntman. And this movie was one of Dar Robinson's last three movies. His other two were Cyclone and Million Dollar Mystery, and all three of these movies are actually dedicated to him. He died in a stunt while he was filming Million Dollar Mystery, where he drove his motorcycle off a cliff. So that's who this guy was. I don't know what stunt he did in this movie, but maybe he was one of the guys that jumped off the side of the building and forgot to hold his friend's hand and pissed Sean off for years.
Gosh darn it.
But the end! That's Lethal Weapon! Now, Colin, Chris, on IMDb, it scored a 7.6 out of 10, has a Metascore of 68. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 81% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 86%. But Colin, those are just numbers. What did people have to say about it?
Alrighty. So I got three interesting reviews. I'm just going to start with this one. So Mike Massey from a website called Gone with the Twins says, an enduring buddy film, brilliantly combining drama, comedy, adventure, bloodshed, machine gun showdowns in the middle of busy highways, and excessive property destruction. So I feel like that one provides a pretty good synopsis.
Yep.
Definitely.
But I can't tell completely whether he liked it or didn't like it.
He did like it. He gave it a certified fresh rating.
Yeah, that's just an accurate summary of the movie.
Yeah, that's basically just your 60-second synopsis right there.
So Google user Blood Legend.
The
one and only Blood Legend.
The original, yeah. This isn't Blood Legend _ 69 or something like that. Okay, this is the OG Blood Legend. Okay.
So, I feel like I want to attempt this in a Russian accent since his name is Blood Legend. But I'm not confident I can pull it off. But,
give it a shot. There's always the edit.
Okay.
Yeah, we can do it twice here if you want, and so, I'll edit one of them out.
Let's go. It is a good film to watch, and people watch it for entertainment. But I was just, I read that, and then I was like, isn't that just every movie? Isn't every movie you just watch for entertainment? So, but he gave it a 5 out of 5.
Okay. So it's good entertainment.
Good entertainment.
Very good entertainment.
And then this one is from Richard Schickel with Time Magazine, and I can't decide if it's racist or not, so I'm just gonna read it.
Okay.
So,
I'm sure the two white guys will be perfect to determine for you.
Okay, here goes. So, an exclamation point. What a concept! Mad Max meets the Cosby Show.
When was that review written? Like that, you said Time Magazine, so this is from when the movie came out, right?
It's hard to tell because I got it from Rotten Tomatoes and they just put it in like I think it said it was from 2017, but I don't think it's that recent.
Yeah, I'd like to think that this review is from before we found out what a scumbag Bill Cosby
was. Yeah, Bill Cosby hasn't aged well, just physically and in the public eye.
And really, why would you go, if you're going to drop an 80s sitcom, why would you go with the Cosby Show when right there you have Family Matters where you have a cop as the dad? Like that draws an even better parallel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those are my reviews for this week.
Outstanding. So yeah, we've got 7.6, 68, 81, and 86. Rotten Tomatoes always liking our movies more. It's both of your first watch. Let's start with our guest, Chris. What did you think of your first watch of Lethal Weapon? Where would it fall for you?
Honestly, those reviews are, I think they hold up. I would give it a 6 or a 7 out of 10 if I had to rate the movie. I have a habit of rating movies when I watch them just because I have a list going of movies and what I think about them, but I have a very hard time giving movies anything below like a 5 unless it's a really bad movie.
Yeah.
But this one definitely gets probably a 7.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't ask this when Colin mentioned it, but have you seen any of the other Lethal Weapons, or is like this whole franchise?
I've seen Lethal Weapon 5.
They are actually making a Lethal Weapon 5, or supposedly it's in the works.
Oh, well, I'm talking about the Always Sunny one. I've seen that episode, Lethal Weapon 5, where they switch characters.
Right. No, but yeah, okay, I love Always Sunny. You got me into it this year. And yes, Lethal Weapon 5 is wildly offensive, but absolutely hilarious. But yeah, no, like there is a legitimate Lethal Weapon 5 in works, and I've seen the mock-up poster for it where the tagline is still too old for this.
Well, are they getting the return actors, or are they?
It's got Danny Glover and Mel Gibson on the poster.
Okay, because they had the TV show going for a while, right? Did that end recently?
Yes.
Yeah, it ended.
Yeah, and you know, I actually did like the Lethal Weapon TV series.
That was one I saw you watching.
The guy that played Riggs on that, though, apparently was really difficult to work with.
That's what I heard. Yeah.
And even though I didn't like his portrayal of Riggs at first, I eventually got into it, and just like I really did adore that show. But then they got rid of Riggs and brought in Sean William Scott, which was also fun, but now all of a sudden it's not Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, they get rid of 50% of it. Yeah.
Yeah, but it at least lasted longer than the Rush Hour TV series that they tried to bring out.
There's a Rush Hour TV series?
Yep. Oh, it came out right about the same time as Lethal Weapon.
Shit. I gotta go watch
The Rush Hour. It's so bad.
Yeah.
It's so bad. It lacks everything that makes the Rush Hour movie good.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Damn. Yeah.
Okay, so Colin, your first watch, you said Lethal Weapon 4. Is that the only other one that you've ever seen? Or have you seen 2 or 3? Okay.
I think I've seen bits and pieces of 3, because I remember, I think 3 is the one that has the toilet thing.
Oh, see, and I thought it was 2.
But either way, I mostly remember Joe Pesci.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember like seeing bits of it with Joe Pesci. I mean, my mom loved the Lethal Weapon movies, so they were probably on in the house. Well, I was around, I just had never actually sat down and watched them.
Yeah, Joe Pesci is in the next 3. And then, like, when
the
it came to...
three?
Yeah, he's in 2, 3, and 4. And it's... with Lethal Weapon 4, it's almost like they added Chris Rock in that movie because they wanted someone to... Oh, Joe Pesci. Because he... like, the Leo Getz character, they wanted someone that, like, had the same, like, high energy... bitchiness attitude. Okay, but so Lethal Weapon 4, that's the one you had seen before. So what was your experience of Lethal Weapon 1 now?
I think, like we said before, it was not the movie I was expecting, but I still really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Like, I think the thing about it, too, is I also haven't seen a lot of Mel Gibson movies, and the little bit that I know of him is, like, kind of, like, after he went off the rocker a little bit.
Yeah, so, pretty much, yeah.
So it was cool to, like, watch him be an actual actor, and like, and he's very good. Surprisingly,
I'm sure he plays that character excellently.
Well, yeah. And the thing that I wonder too is because of the fact that, you know, Bruce Willis was one of the possibilities for this, and he was one of the possibilities for Die Hard. I just wonder what that would have been like if you had switched those two characters.
There's
up.
An alternate universe out there where that happened. Yeah,
yeah. So yeah. Where do you rate it?
I would give it like a 60. Nah, I would probably fall between like a 70, between 70 and 80%. So I'll just go 75%.
Yeah, it's split a good buddy cop movie.
I love buddy cop movies. You don't really get to see them as much anymore. Like, I think the last one I really liked was the 21 and 22 Jump Street movies with Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill, but
very good movies.
Oh yeah, I didn't even I said Ride Along and no one at that point said 21 Jump Street. Fuck, guys. Yeah. Come on, get my back on this.
Now that you mention it, those are excellent buddy cop movies for sure.
Well, and, yeah. And what that Rock Kevin Hart one, what is it? Central Intelligence?
Oh yeah, Central Intelligence.
The other Kevin Hart buddy cop movie.
I think there's opportunity to bring the buddy cop genre back. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is that stops them from doing it. It seems like the type of formula that could just go on forever and always be enjoyable.
Well, the Lethal Weapon formula, particularly, if Lethal Weapon 5 is a for real thing, like, that is kind of interesting in today's world to have a black cop and a white cop working together and see what their different perspectives are on subjects related to police, like police brutality and etc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, especially if he were to do it now, yeah.
Because, like, the scene, I have it circled on my page that the ice cream is better than acknowledging police brutality, which is hilarious. But to do that scene in kind of a 2020 context would be even funnier or sadder, depending on how they play the scene.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I fall kind of in the same area as you guys. Yeah, mid-70s. Yeah, I can get behind that. It's a good movie, but as I blur together the franchise as a whole, I definitely liked some of the other ones in the franchise a bit more, but I was very impressed with where this movie went in some cases, with how dark it is compared to the lightness of the future movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, verdict, Christmas movie?
Absolutely. I think there's no argument there.
Yeah, I would
agree.
This
movie is definitely Christmas and rated R. If we had to put it into two categories, that it definitely is. Yeah.
I was thinking about it, and my theory about why they have to throw all the Christmas stuff in your face, I think it's because it's in California and there's no snow.
Yeah.
Mm.
Like, I think maybe if it was snowing and there was snow on the ground, you would just be like, oh yeah, it's Christmas time.
California Christmas is very odd. There's that scene in Edward Scissorhands where they're stapling fake snow to the roof that always threw me off when I watched that movie.
Yeah, because Die Hard, exact same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's California Christmas movie, but at least the second one has snow.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. That is Lethal Weapon, and that's our show for this week. And a big, huge thank you to our special guest this week, Chris Wells. Thank you for joining us, coming all the way upstairs from the basement to join me today for this podcast.
It was a long trek. It dumped a foot of snow last night. I didn't think I was going to be able to make it, but I'm glad I did. It was a productive conversation. I have two more honorable mentions for best quips of the movie, if we have time real quick.
Okay.
When Gary Busey goes to steal a car on the freeway, he jumps in the passenger seat and goes, "Mind if I test drive your Audi?" And also,
how did I miss Audi? Oh, sponsorship corner.
And from the award-winning director of Passion of the Christ, Danny Glover at one point goes, "God hates me," and Mel Gibson quips back with, "Hate him back. It works for me." Excellent.
Nice.
That's amazing.
If you like that show, oh boy, one thing you can do for us is share it. Tell your friends. Get us out there. Get our name known to people. And if you really want to help us out on the business end, go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on. Give us 5 stars. It doesn't really matter what you say. You can say, ho, ho, ho. But it's those 5 stars that just drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
Yeah, and as always, if you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com, all one word. Check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our podcasts and our social medias. We got Facebook, we got Instagram, we got Twitter. Social media is the best place to go to find out what we're going to be watching. If you can go on there, give us a few likes, like our stuff, share our posts, and just spread the word.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter and the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us for more season festivities next week as we take a look at another Christmas movie on I Used to Like This One.